still a Cleveland alcoholic.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank Argnor for those beautiful words, but I have no idea what he said. We've been starting each session with 3 minutes of silence, and I'm not going to do that to you. But I would like to have it a moment of silence, just a moment with no chimes or anything. And what I'd like you to do, if you would, with me, is think about the people that were here when you got to Alcoholics Anonymous that were kind to you, that cared about you, that listened to you when you spoke to them, that offered you a seat in the room, that got you a cup of coffee, that made you feel welcome. Maybe the person that remembered your name when you came back to the meeting the next time and how that made you feel. So let's just take just a moment and put those people close to our hearts. Thank you. There was a guy named Larry Larkin. He later became the manager of the Ilano Club, and I came up there one night, and Larry took an interest in me, and we stood out in the parking lot of the Ilano Club for 45 minutes, and he talked to me. And when I left there that night, I just felt like I was part of, because Larry knew everybody, and he took an interest in me. I later found out that Larry would talk to anybody that was standing in front of him. I'd like to thank Baldwin and Arnor for inviting us here. You have, well, maybe you do, but you probably don't have any idea what a wonderful experience this is for us on several levels. It's just a great experience for all three of us and our wives to just be together. I mean, it just doesn't happen, you know, for all three of us that care about each other so much and we love each other's wives. We don't sleep with each other's wives. As far as I'm aware, but it's still early. And, but to just be able to travel here and have this grand adventure and see this beautiful country. You people live in a true power spot on the planet. We drove around a little, Baldwin took us around and showed us, and it's just incredible, just the power of nature here. It's incredibly invigorating. And what a great opportunity just to see the place and to be together. And then on another level, to be able to share with you what we feel so strongly about. I don't know about you, but my life got saved. Something happened to me, March of 1985, that I have no rational explanation for. On March the 27th, 1985, the obsession to drink and use drugs was lifted from me, and my life has never been the same. And for 22 years, I've been trying to get closer to whatever it is that saved my life. And come to find out that you're the vehicle for me to get closer to whatever that power is. So it's just really neat to be here. It's really a treat. And I thank you for the opportunity. I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran. And I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me. But I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. I was just a badass Viking. So I see there's some other phonies in the room. They don't laugh at that stuff down at the Kiwanis Club, you know, or the Chamber of Commerce. They don't get it, you know. And, and that's my story, you know. I was full of shit all my life. And pretending to be something, trying to be something. Isn't that what we do out there? I mean, this weekend we've talked a lot about feeling disconnected, that we never felt part of. We all have our own way of describing that. One of the things that we all realize when we come to AA is when we hear people talking about that, the first realization is, my God, there's other people that feel that way. It's almost become cliche, but when you're new, that's probably the first time you've ever heard people talk about feeling, I never felt part of my family. Everybody looks at kids, you know. Today I walk around and be in a supermarket and you'll see some family with some little kids, and I think to myself, I wonder if one of those kids wonders where his real parents are, you know. You know, I mean, because that's kind of how all of us sort of feel that way, some more than others. And we get to AA and we start hearing people talk about that. And then we come to realize after a while that, my God, I was pretending to be stuff so that I could feel part of something. And then as soon as I got close to it, I bailed out, you know, because I didn't want them to find out that I'm not really with them. So it's a self-fulfilling thing. It just feeds on itself. By the time I was 17 years old, I was a bad drunk in high school. I was beyond redemption. I was beyond help. I started drinking when I was 15, maybe 14, probably closer to 15 years old. And in 2 years, I was gone. In 2 years. First time I drank, a friend of mine's brother was in a college fraternity, and we helped him pull a practical joke on his fraternity brothers, and he let us drink whatever we wanted, 2 glasses of whatever we wanted. And we got these big plastic 16-ounce glasses, just poured everything we could think of in there. Because we'd all, you know, like when you're kids, you sip a little beer here and there, but I hadn't really gotten hammered, and I was looking forward to it, you know? And so we choked this stuff down and got drunker than hell, and I caused some trouble at the party. And they loaded me in a car, drove me back to my parents' house, and dumped me out on the front lawn. I crawled in the house and crawled down the hallway and got back into the bedroom. And I'm laying on the bed with 1 foot on the floor trying to stop the spinning, you know. And back in those days, back in the olden days, we had these big plastic things called records. I'm sure it's a big black plastic with a little hole in the middle. And we played them on pieces of furniture called record players. And some of these pieces of furniture had a lid on it. So I puked in the record player. You know? It was right next to the bed, you know, kind of head high. And I crawled down the hallway, and I got into the bathroom, and I'm sitting on the toilet, and I can't think of the words that Matthew used, but it was coming out both ends. You know, he's a better student than me, and I'm puking in the bucket and, you know, doing that. And the bathroom door opens up, and I look up, and the tears are running down my face, and I see my mother standing there with this aghast expression on her face, and my father standing behind her laughing hysterically. And each of them were saying in their own way, it begins. It was especially poignant in my house because when I was 16, six years old, my dad got fired from a job. And rather than go to the bar, he came home, which was extraordinary. And I'm pretty sure it was my mother that called AA. And he went down to a meeting in Inglewood, California. And he came back from that meeting and he told my mother, he says, you know, those people have got something down there. And I'm going to go back and find out what it is. So the next night, she went with him in order to monitor the experience. So they go walking in this place and my mother, if you ever saw my mother, the last thing that would come to your mind was alcoholic. She was very statuesque, beautiful woman, always well kept all the time, no matter what happened. And this woman came running up to her and said, "What are you doing here?" And she says, "Well, I'm here to make sure he fills out the forms, signs the papers, you know, pays the dues, and for the intake program, you know." And this woman took my mother into the other room. When my father died in 1999, he was 45 years sober. When my mother passed away in 2002, she was 48 years in Al-Anon. So I grew up in one of those horrible, sober, alcoholic homes, you know. I hear people talk about shit flying around the house and screaming and yelling. All I think of is freedom. And what was happening to me is I was living in a house with two people with clear eyes that knew exactly what was going on in my head. I mean, you go around the corner to smoke one and they're waiting for you, you know. Where are you going? You know? Because they know where the corner is. And I grew up in a house where I would come home from school many times. There would be somebody laying on the back porch waiting for their sponsor to come home. We had weird uncles around the house all the time. You know? Some of you may have experienced this. There's usually a few of us in the crowd, you know, that had these weird uncles. We had one weird uncle named Harold, and Harold just couldn't get sober, and my dad would give him jobs around the house. He was a carpenter and stuff, and Harold would fix and repair things. My dad would give him money, find some clothes for him, and take him to meetings. Harold had no car, and he couldn't hold a job. And after a while, Harold finally got sober, and pretty soon he was dressing nice, coming over to the house, and he had a car, and he got a job, and he's going to meetings, my dad and him, and Harold's looking good. And he meets a girl on the AA campus, and I went to the wedding when they got married. And then he got drunk. Then he got divorced. Then I went to his funeral when he burned himself up alive in a hotel room, drunk, smoking in bed. And I was probably 13 years old when he died, is best my recollection. But I was very clear. I knew why he died. He died because he drank. I knew it wasn't an accident. You know, I was real clear on that. I knew why this man died. One day I came home and there was a woman hiding in the garage. That was the Al-Anon. Don't make Al-Anon jokes if you don't know what it is. But if you know what it is, you can make some great Al-Anon jokes. Stop and think of the consciousness of an individual that would live with us on purpose. What are they thinking? You know? Oh, this will be fun. You know? Kind of like restoring an old car on the weekends or something, I guess. You know? I don't know. And, I am living proof that self-knowledge as a treatment for alcoholism is worthless. I grew up in one of those houses. I grew up, but this was before the hospitals had figured out how to make money out of us. This was 1954, and this was in the 50s. And when you went on a 12-step call, you brought them home. There was nowhere else to take them. And I have many memories of my father going out on one of those midnight rides and bringing some guy back to the house, and they'd sit there and pound on the book and point at him and tell him the same lame stuff we tell him today. You know, not much has changed, really. There's a lot of stuff that has infiltrated into Alcoholics Anonymous, but the basic message of AA is the same. It's the same message as it always was. So at 17, I was gone. Last place I wanted to be was living with my parents. They were the two of the lamest people I'd ever met in my life, you know. Any of you have teenagers, do you ever reach that point where they finally look at you and you can see that look in their eye where they think you are the stupidest person they ever met in their life? You know, 3 weeks ago, they were still playing catch with you out in the front yard, you know. But I didn't like my parents. I hated my parents. I didn't have anger, I had rage. And when I was 13 years old, my mother took me to my first psychiatrist. I would double up, fall on the floor, bile from my stomach would come up in my throat, veins throbbing in my neck, eyes bulging, pound my fist into the wall, my head into the wall. I was just pissed off at the injustice of it all. And I had no idea, I had no focus for it. But the closest people that were handy was my parents. And the doctor's opinion, it tells us, the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. How do we make that happen? I mean, it takes a great intellect to construct a reality around you that makes it okay to sleep with the neighbor's wife and puke on your friends and do all the real cute stuff that we do and kind of step back from it and say, oh, what the hell, you know? It's not so bad. You know? You don't need any other proof that alcoholism is physiological other than that last 3 to 5 years that you and I stayed out there. What's that all about? You know, nobody would consciously do that to themselves. There's no party. There's no party. What the hell? Wasn't the whole idea was to have a party? Wasn't that the idea behind the drinking thing? When it first started, the idea was to have a couple of drinks and get out of the house and go out and have some adventures, go to the party, get lucky, meet her, you know, do something, have a good time, feel part of, you know, the social lubricant, you know. I don't know about you, but I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. Party! You know? I mean, I'm having sex, menage a uno. There's no one else in the room, you know? And they're not lining up at the door. Nobody's coming to the door. Can Billy come out and play? You know? The hell happened to the party? That's when the new guys come in now and they'll tell you stuff like, well, I was just a party kind of guy, you know? And I go, describe the party to me. How many other people were at the party? Number one. Well, there were 3 or 4. Did you know any of them, or did you just walk in off the street? So I went to this shrink at 13, and he helped me. And the primary thing he did for me is he introduced me to my favorite subject, me. That lifelong pursuit of self. You know, trying to get in touch with me. You know, closer to me. More understanding and compassionate of myself. You know, more loving, more caring. Bonding with me. You know, I love it. I do psychotherapy extremely well. You would love to have me in your group. I am really interactive, you know, and I can feign compassion and caring, and it's wonderful, you know. So at 17, I'm the bad drunk in high school, and I had the slouch, I had the sneer, I had the foul mouth, I had the uniform, the outfit, the bad attitude, and I was irretrievable. And at 18 years old, for some odd reason, somehow I found somebody to marry me. I think she slept with me, so it seemed like we should get married. You know? And I'm scared to death of women. I'm scared to death of everything. And I on 4th of July in Bass Lake, California, the Hell's Angels rode in that valley in 1966, and I found my career path. I want to be a gangster, an outlaw, a gunslinger, a badass, you know, ride them Harleys and stuff. And she happened to be in the vicinity, so we went up to Oregon to grow our own. And it was the 60s, man. You know, it was the 60s. You'll hear people say, I wouldn't trade my worst day sober for my best day drunk. I wouldn't trade 66 and 67 for anything, man. It was incredible. It was incredible. I'm pretty sure I had a really good time, you know? I mean, from all the reports, it was happening, you know? And I've read about what happened since. There's been a lot of books have been written. I had no idea I was involved in that much stuff, you know? It was, like, really interesting. I graduated from high school in 65. The road from Los Angeles to San Francisco was the road to Nirvana. Golden Gate Park was the center of the universe, you know? They weren't eating hitchhikers yet, so it was safe to travel, you know? And the young ladies were discovering their sexuality, and we were helping them as best we could. You know? So I went up there, we immediately had two children. You know, kids come from sex, you know? Who knew? Boom, boom. We should back off a little. So I had two children. I had bought a house. I was running with an outlaw motorcycle gang. I was sticking needles in my arm every day, and I wasn't coming home to that family, and they were on welfare. And I was out on Highway 99 doing what we do, and I lost that family, and I lost those children to divorce, and I lost the house, and I lost a couple of cars and several jobs. And by the time I was 22 years old, I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution. I needed a rest. It's rough changing the world, you know? And the way you end up in a mental institution is not because you had a bad week. You have to build up a certain level of toxicity to qualify for the mental institution. Anybody else here been in a mental institution? I know Chuck has. You know Chuck was in a mental institution. He flew from Honolulu, Hawaii to Iceland in the winter. That's crazy. Some of you are probably thinking, well, it really wasn't an institution. They were just observing me, you know? It's like, only those of us that have been in the mental institution know that it's not that bad. You have some sparkling conversations in the mental institution. It's a great place to look for a bride. I'd like to introduce you to my wife, Karen. Stand up, dear. For the tape, I have to say I did not find her in the mental institution. Unless you count AA. So I'm in a mental institution at 22. I started drinking at 15 years old. Seriously started drinking at 15. And probably that first year I wasn't drunk every weekend. By the time I was 17, I was getting hammered every weekend. And at 22, I'm in a mental institution. What the hell happened to the party? You know? The party for most of us, it seems like it ends pretty quick. I'm one of those people that never crossed a line. I didn't know there was a line. You know, truly nothing happened in my life. Nothing happened. You know, yeah, I got married and I did some stuff, but I didn't go anywhere. I didn't do anything. I didn't leave my mark on anything. I was an exceptional nothing. You know, I started drinking and my life literally stopped. It just stopped, and no advancement was made of any kind. I can't really tell you stories about the 60s because I'm not sure really what the truth is. I mean, I lied about it for so many years, I have convinced myself that some of that stuff actually happened. I'm pretty sure I did not live with Joan Baez. But I said I did, you know. I made up all kinds of crap, you know. I mean, just I had to create a life Because I had none. I had none. And it's been my experience that most of our stories are like that. You know, thank God there's some people that actually did some shit, so we've got something to listen to, you know. I wish I could tell you I was a wheel man for the mob, you know, or I was a jet plane pilot. You ever heard the guy Red Abernathy talks about he was flying the X-planes, you know, when he got up, the next morning he was supposed to fly this special X-plane, break the speed of sound, and he wakes up in the morning and he's late. Oh, my God. And he rushes down to the landing strip, and there's the plane smoking on the ground. He looks at the flight log, and he signed it. You know, that didn't happen to me. You know, I'm sorry, but it's a great story, isn't it? Flying night missions over North Korea, you know, and with the bottle of whiskey down in your big fur boot, you know. That did not happen to me. You know, nothing happened to me. I went to the mental institution. That happened to me. And then I went back a second time because I liked it there. You know? I have to remember that the way I ended up in the mental institution is I called the police on myself. Now, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's sometimes a controversy. There are no issues in AA, so we have to make up stuff and then recycle it every so often to give general service something to talk about. And one of the issues is the alcoholic and the drug addict, are they the same? Is there a difference? Is the recovery the same? What about the alcoholic addict and all of that stuff? Anybody that's lived out on the street knows that there's a difference between alcoholics and drug addicts. And I'll give you an operational definition of that difference. No self-respecting drug addict would ever call the police on himself. But an alcoholic will do it and think it's a pretty good idea. There is a level of lameness in the alcoholic that simply does not exist in the hip, contemporary rock and roll drug addict of today. You know? All those in favor? I'll call New York. So I came back down to Los Angeles. One of the requirements of being an alcoholic is you must hate your parents. It's a requirement. You know, guys come in and tell me, I don't hate my parents. I go, see you later. Get out there, work on that a little bit, and come back, call me later. You know, because you just got to hate them. They're the closest ones. You know, for the alcoholic life to seem like the only normal one, rule number one, it must be someone else's fault. I can never, ever take responsibility for my own behavior because my behavior is unjustifiable. Therefore, the motivation for behaving that way has got to be you because you're infringing upon my fun and you're an asshole. You know? And I've been sent by God to wreak vengeance on your life and make you... It's kind of a religious sort of thing. And, So I hated my parents, but when you need something, you can overlook certain things. So I came back down to Los Angeles, and I needed something, and my dad gave me a job in his machine shop in El Segundo, and he let me sleep in his garage. And by this time, my father had been sober a long time. And my mother, when I went to that mental institution, she flew up to Oregon and drove me to that institution. That must have been a real high point in her life. Her only son, you know, and that must have been a rough day for her. I have no recollection, really, of anything that she might have been feeling or said. I just know I needed a ride. And I was strung out really bad, and I was in bad shape. I was scared to death. I was running with people that were armed and dangerous, and I had no business being with those people and doing what I was doing. I have no idea how I ended up there, really, to be honest with you. And she drove me there. So I came back down to California, and I tried to get normal. And I tried to clean up my act. And the first thing you got to do to get normal is you got to quit shooting heroin because you can't find anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. It's pretty much a lifestyle. you got to quit taking LSD because you got to talk to people. And acid is not conducive to two-way communication. You pretty much have to stop doing that. So what you do is you just drink on the weekends and smoke pot during the week because marijuana really isn't drugs. It's green and it's from God. It's biodegradable. It's herbal, you know. And marijuana is what you do in between getting really loaded. You know, it's just maintenance. Because see, there has to be some cushion between you and I. I can't take you just on naked blood. The impact of your personality on me is devastating. And I need something to cushion the blow. You know? And for 20 years there was always something in my system. And so I tried the experiment of drinking on the weekends because normal people have jobs. And when I drink, I don't show up no matter what. Everything stops when I drink. Literally, everything stops. And so I tried to control it. I tried to control it as best I could. And as I'm sure your experiment failed, so did mine. By the time I was 37 years old, which was another 15 years after that mental institution, I crashed and burned. And there was no more hip dope. It was me and a gin bottle. Nothing else was left. I couldn't smoke pot anymore because I started seeing God, and that was never the idea, you know. I don't know what the hell you people did to that stuff, but it was not the old Mexican dirt weed I was used to back in the 60s, you know. And so I had to quit doing that because it made me too paranoid. I just drank. I just drank. I just drank, and I drank, and I drank, and I drank. And I drank my soul up. So when I was 37, on one of the last drunk so far, certainly wasn't the worst one. There was nothing monumental about it. I came home in the morning and I was in the wrong place in the morning again. You know that feeling? When you're there and you know you're not going to make it to work and everybody that was waiting for you is no longer waiting for you. And you know it's going to be another miserable, horrible, painful day. Another one on top of the hundreds that came before it. I'm not going to feel good. It's just going to be awful. I'm sticky and I'm sweaty and I itch everywhere. There's nothing left to drink. You know? And like any good gangster, I called my mom. You ever notice? You ever notice how many tough guys come to AA and you find out they're living with mom? And on top of that, they complain about the bitch. She doesn't understand me. Man, you're 45 years old. God. Oh. Mom came and got me. And she loaded me in the car before I changed my mind. And took me to this place in Costa Mesa called Starting Point. Now, first shrink at 13, two times in the mental institution. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been to a handful of other psychiatrists for one thing or another. I've been gestalted and rolfed and primal screamed. I know more about myself than is safe to know. But it is my favorite subject, you know. So I could not imagine just coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and sitting in meetings and not drinking. Could you? Every one of us at some point in our drinking career has gotten up in the morning or whenever and looked in the mirror and looked yourself right in the eye and said, I got to cut this shit out. You know? Then the next thought is, I need a drink. You know? Isn't that true? Every one of us. How many of you have sat in a bar with some alcoholic buddy of yours and discussed the level of your personal alcoholism with each other as you're ordering another round? Anybody done that? So yeah, so we all know what the problem is. But you can't imagine not drinking. I mean, I couldn't imagine it. Could you? I couldn't imagine it. I knew I needed to be locked up. I knew I was dying. I could feel death coming up behind me. I've got liver disease, and I had it really bad then, and I could feel it when the end was near. So my mother brought me there, and she checked me in this place. While I was in there, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. It was a little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it that said, "I am not a counselor." Because evidently there was some confusion about that. So then they let us out. They let us out. They let us out. Say, go, multiply. You know, now, during the time I was trying to get normal, I found another volunteer that was willing to take care of me and got married. Because part of being a normal, an alcoholic of my variety, I can never, ever be alone. In fact, it's a group effort getting me through life. You know, it takes a village. You know, it's still like that today. You know, it's like not much has changed in that area. You know, I'm a high maintenance guy. You know, and so I had another wife. I had two more small children, and my dad had pretty much retired from the small business that we had, and the reason you couldn't fire me from the job is because I was the boss. And they let me out, and they send us to the world's aftercare program, AA. There are no referrals from Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no place you go where you walk in and you say to them, "I'm from AA, they sent me here." That place does not exist. This is it. This is the last house on the street. It's linoleum floors and metal folding chairs for the rest of our natural lives. You know, Barty. You know, God, I was happy to be here in my old man's club. You know, it was a real thrill. And I showed up here. Now, what are we like when we get here? What are the common themes that run through all of our stories? Because my experience of 20 plus years of working with people and reading the book with people and working with them, we're all different. We'd like to talk about how we're the same, and there are ways that we're the same, but there are significant differences too. Where we came from, what happened to us. Some of us have scars that other ones don't have. Some of us have demons that others don't have. But there is a common theme. Now, one of the things that you'll hear in Alcoholics Anonymous is you hear the term alcoholic thinking, as if there really is such a thing. The rest of the world calls it what I think it really is, emotional immaturity, right? And we hear that and we go, no. I have alcoholic thinking. I have special thinking. It's unique. It's special thinking, and you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. I have alcoholic thinking. I'm a sick puppy, and I hope I never get well. You know, I have alcoholic thinking. And we hang on to that with a death grip, you know, because if we can have that special thinking, it answers a lot of very strange questions, you know, and odd behavior that we have, like being 40 years old and laying on the floor kicking and screaming and crying and yelling for mom. You know, what's that about? You know? And all of us do that, right? I believe truly, I believe literally that this is true, that when I started drinking and using, therefore you too, I stopped growing emotionally. I stopped, literally, stopped. There I am. So now I'm 37 years old and I'm a newcomer in AA, and on a good day I have the emotional development of a 16-year-old. And this kid is not an honor student. He's the one with a bit of a problem with authority, you know. And he's still swaggering and walking around and acting the way he acts, you know, with his special thinking, you know, and his special bag of crap that he's brought back from the horrible childhood that he had, you know. Here I am, you know, I'm ready for you. Let's work some steps, you know. It's not conducive to healthy step working. The chances of me growing up in middle age and looking good are really slim. You know, this is not going to be cute. You know. Have you ever had anybody say to you, "He's not emotionally available for me"? You ever heard that one? Anybody ever heard that? Usually it's in family group, you know. But you know what they mean by that? What they mean by that is I've got something that they want, and I'm withholding it. And the truth is worse. I don't have it. And what's worse than that, I don't know that I don't have it. You've convinced me that I've got it, and I'm helping you look for it. And this is going to go on for a long time, you know. And now we are on the journey together. And remember the special thinking. So we're growing up. We're going to grow up now. This now comes the opinion part of the pitch. I want to make it very clear that these are just my opinions, but they definitely should be yours as well. You know how you hear people say there are no experts in Alcoholics Anonymous? Bullshit. I'm an expert. So let's get down to it now. If I'm going to grow up, which we're all still waiting for, I should never do this in front of my sponsor. It's gonna be hell to pay for this. If I'm gonna grow up, if you want me to be there for you, if you would like me to be emotionally available for you, to really care for you, to take you into consideration when I'm making decisions on my life, to feel what you feel, not just to react to how you feel, but to really put myself in your shoes, to come to understand you at a deeper level and allow you into me, without being afraid, with no blockages, just openly, to let you in, to have that kind of a relationship. If you would like that from me, it's going to take about 10 years. 10 years. You ever watched a teenager? I have some. And the second little bunch I was available for, and I watched them. And at about 14 or 15 years old, they start growing up. They start doing adult-looking things, very awkwardly. and they make a series of horrible mistakes. And then they seem to learn from those mistakes. And by the time they're around 25 years old, you stand there one day and you look at them and you go, God damn, she grew up. I mean, you look at them, they got breasts and stuff, and they're like big people, you know? And for us alcoholics, have you ever had the experience that maybe they're a little bit more well-rounded than you? I've had that. I had a recent conversation with my 22-year-old son and my 25-year-old daughter around Christmas time. We had a party over at my house. Karen's family was there. And the three of us kind of found ourselves together, and we're talking, kind of going over the past. And we all agreed that all three of us had grown up quite a bit. And the two of them are looking at me smiling, and I'm smiling right back at them, you know. I've done pretty good, kids, haven't I? You know, you're okay, Dad, you know. It's been a long time since you threw yourself down on the front lawn, you know. It's like, you know, haven't seen you cry at inappropriate times in several years now, you know. I think you're really getting better, you know, and but it takes them about 10 years. My son was 15 or 16 years old. And I went up to him and I said, what happened between you and Brittany? And he said, well, you know how when you tell a girl that you don't love her so that you can see what her reaction is to find out whether she really loves you or not? You know how you do that? And I lied and I went, oh, yeah, yeah. And he says, well, I did that with Brittany, and she just smiled and said, okay, and walked away. And I said, and he looked at me and he goes, I'm never going to do that again. There's a couple of really remarkable things about that conversation. Number one, he had that conversation with his father. I would have never had a conversation like that with my father. I wouldn't have even talked to him about anything. I never did. And the other thing is, it seems as though he actually learned from the experience. You know? Now, my estimation is that you and I missed all of that. You know? We didn't. That didn't happen to us. You know, we didn't learn from the mistakes. We just got loaded instead. And we missed it all. And the only way that we're going to be able to make up for that is to live through the experiences in order to learn from the mistakes and from the victories and grow up. And we get to do it now. And you can't speed it up, but you can definitely slow it down. You'll hear some lies in Alcoholics Anonymous that I think make this problem worse. You'll hear people say that there's a different program for everyone else in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a different program for each one of us. That was made up by an alcoholic that doesn't want to work the program. There's only one. It's real clear what it is. We have a way out upon which we all agree. We all agree what the way out is. We may not all do it, but we all agree what it is. It's stated very clearly. It's hanging on most of the walls that we go into. It's in chapter 5 in the book. It's very clear. The book tells us, we will tell you precisely how we recovered. It's up to me now to work your program, not mine. Okay? So don't give me that way out. And whatever you do, don't tell me to take what I can use and leave the rest. I've lived my life that way my entire life. It's time for a change. I need a new life. I don't need to make, with this finely tuned decision-making instrument up here, decide what's going to be good for me. When have I ever known what was good for me? Ever in my life. I will never consciously put myself in an uncomfortable position. And recovery by its very nature is uncomfortable. The most spiritual thing said in Alcoholics Anonymous is get in the car. Where are we going? What do you care? Get in the car. You know, well, who else is going? What do you care? Get in the car. I need a new experience. I need to let you take me into your life. You've been your own worst enemy. Put yourself at the top of the amends list. Please. I was not my own worst enemy. I was yours. You know? Yes, but you were self-destructive. Well, yeah, but I didn't know that. You know, I'm not that bright. You know, I was making myself feel good at all costs. I was trying to avoid pain at any cost I could, to the exclusion of you in my life. So if I want to make amends to myself, I'll put myself at the bottom of that list, and by the time I get there, I'll have some self-esteem. I think that's how it works. Okay? So I come into AA, I need some help. You know, if I get on my knees and I ask God for help, I shouldn't turn him away when he shows up. And the chances are he's not going to look like I think he's going to look. He's not going to look like that guy on the cross, or he's not going to look like Buddha. He's not going to look like some sadhu, some religious guy with long robes and a stick and, you know, with a sign he's carrying or something. He's not going to look like that. He's going to look a lot like you. He's going to send you to me. So what I need to do is let you in. You are the messenger. You're the one that has the message for me. Sometimes maybe I have the message for you, but it's you. So the absolute very last thing I want to do is control the experience of you in my life. And I will attempt to do that because you are inconvenient as hell. You know, you are in my way. You are impinging upon my fun. You show up at the wrong times. You call all the time. Right in the middle of my favorite rerun of Law and Order, you know? I'm standing in my kitchen one day, and I'm not going to tell the story about Jay and I and working the steps. I've been doing that all weekend. I'm tired of hearing it. But that's what we did. He took me into his life, and he worked the steps with me, and I did an inventory, and I became a member of AA, and I made my amends. And people started walking up to me and asking me for help. And I was motivated solely by ego and pride. I wanted to look good. I have never in my life done a good thing for somebody and then not told somebody else. As far as I'm concerned, if I do a good thing and I don't tell somebody, it did not happen. I want full credit, thank you. And, every once in a while I forget, and then I have to go out and tell everybody, you know? And that's just me, what can I say? God's not done with me yet. And some people say I'm arrogant. Can you believe that? I still haven't been able to figure that one out. But I'm standing in my kitchen one day, and this man, Al, who I'd been sponsoring for a short time. I would imagine I was maybe 3 years sober and he was 1 year sober, something like that. And his mother was dying. And he gave the hospital my phone number because he knew that's where he'd be. And sure enough, they called. And they said, Al, you better get here to the hospital. It looks like she's going to pass. Now, he had been caring for her for a while, and I had listened to him share about this. And I was very impressed by the fact that he was doing this, that he was changing her diapers and popping her hip back into place, and he was taking care of it. His mother, who was not a nice woman, she was not some sweet old lady. She was a mean old thing. And he was left with her. He didn't have health insurance, and he had to take care of her. And by God, he did. And the rest of the family just kind of bailed out and let him do it. So they called, and he's heading back to the hospital, and he wasn't leaving. He was standing there looking at me. And I knew what he wanted. And I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go to the hospital with him. And I knew that that's what he wanted me to do. Now, he had a family, a brother and a sister and other members of his family. For some reason, they trust us more than their own family. Isn't that odd? I wonder what that is, that they trust us. Maybe there's something going on that we're not really, we don't have the radar up high enough to be able to sense what it is. So finally I said to him, I said, Al, do you want me to go with you? And he said, would you please? So I went to the hospital, and I was scared. I'd never seen anybody dying. I'd never been into ICU. I'd just, you know, I didn't want to go. And there's lots of things I could say to myself that would preclude me from going. We don't do that. We just read the book with them. It's about recovery, you know. We're just lay people. We, you know, there's limitations on what we can do. I've got to set my boundaries, you know, is a good one. And there's all kinds of things that we can do to build a structure around these relationships that stop us from doing the really uncomfortable parts. As far as we're concerned, they're uncomfortable. And we limit the relationship. I didn't get raised that way in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got raised to where you never say no. You don't ever say no because you don't know what's going on. So you just say yes. You just do it all. I came up with one on my own. You always answer the phone. Get rid of caller ID. I'm not hiding from anybody. I'm always available. You get rid of caller ID, don't monitor your phone calls, it will change your life. It changed my life. You are always more important than whatever rerun of Law and Order I happen to be watching. Now, I may not believe that, but I know it's true, that I need to be there for you. So I went to the hospital. So I'm in the room, and it's awful. This woman's all hooked up to tubes, and she's, you know, it's awful. It's like what my worst fear. It wasn't cute. It smelled bad, and it looked bad. And I found a chair over in the corner of the room, and I sat there, and I closed my eyes, and I said a prayer, and I asked for help. He helped me get through that. I was scared. I was horrified. And I came out of that, and something came over me. Something happened. Something came over me. I didn't hear any words, but a feeling came over me that everything's okay. There's nothing wrong here, Bill. This is the way it's supposed to be. It's all right. Just breathe. And Al's stomping around the room. And I said, come over here and sit down. And I had him sit down next to me. He's a great big guy like me. He's got even got bigger hands. He's a carpenter. And I held his hand, and I looked him right in the eye, and I said, everything's okay, Al. There's nothing wrong. Just relax. It's going to be all right. There's nothing wrong here. And we said a prayer together. And when he was hanging on to me, when we said that prayer, during the course of the prayer, he relaxed his grip in my hand. That's intimacy. That's what it's like. And I miss it all the time. I'm looking for a head rush. That's all I know. I've come to find out that emotions, for the most part, are quiet. And they're subtle. And I miss them all the time because I'm looking for something else, or I'm looking over your shoulder, looking to see if there's a better conversation across the room. And I'm talking to you, but I'm waiting for you to stop so that I can start, which isn't listening. It's just taking up space, you know? And I don't know how to listen. I don't know how to interact with you. I never learned. I never learned. I never grew up. And now what's going to happen? And the only place I've ever found that it happens is when I'm in an uncomfortable situation that I'm not in control of, that I'm not in charge of, and I don't know how to behave, and I'm just winging it. And I'm looking for help, and I need guidance. I'm out of my rut. I'm out of my comfort zone. And I'm having new experiences that deepen me as a person. Sometime later, my friend Chris Gantner had a 7-year-old boy who got cancer. And it took him 2 years, and he died. And he called me up, and he said, my son's dying of cancer. I don't know what to do. And I went to the hospital, and I thought, well, I went through this other thing. And I walked into that room with a dying 7-year-old boy, and I was horrified. He was the same age as my kids. It scared the shit out of me. And I couldn't wait to get out of that room. I wanted to be there for him, but I did not have what it takes to be in that room. And I left, and I felt kind of cowardly, and I felt frightened, and I didn't know what to do, and I called my sponsor. And I said, this is what's going on. What should I do? And he says, I'll be there. I'll be right there. And he came, and we went together into that room and helped this guy. And we spent 2 years in that room off and on. The last couple of months, almost every day. And the little boy died. It did not have a happy ending. We stood around and held hands at his bedside and prayed for his death. It was so horrible. And then when he died, his father called me up and he says, remember how we prayed for his death? I'd give anything to have him back just one more day. And it broke my heart. It just broke my heart. And like Jay loves to say, it broke my heart open. Now I can run away. I can run away from these things and go, boy, I'm never going to do that again. Or I can learn from the experience and know I didn't die from it. And this man is not that much different than me. I know what it would be like now if one of my kids got sick. I know how I'd be. I'd be just like my friend Chris. I'd be out of my mind. It would be awful. It would be horrible. But I would live. I wouldn't die. My friend Patrick Keelahan got lung cancer. We watched him die. We were there with him when he died. He was the devil of all. He was a horrible man, actually. And upon his death, he became a saint. You know, but he was an Irish pig. He used to kiss my wife right on the mouth, right in front of me, and then step back and look at me and laugh hysterically. You know, he was just a horrible guy. He was my friend. He and I loved him. And he had two small children, and he died. And we used to take him to retreats with us. And he said one of the most powerful things I've ever heard in an AA meeting. He said, if you're not grateful, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. And I watched him die. And then the call came. My father, whom I hated this man. On his 70th birthday, when I was 1 year sober, I made amends to him. 10 years later, he made amends to me. Don't leave before the miracle. You know, 10 years later. The last 15 years of his life, of our life together, was just wonderful. The last 10 was just incredible. I found my daddy. We healed with each other. His birthday is March the 28th. Mine was March the 27th. For 14 years in the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, we gave each other birthday cakes. I found my father in Alcoholics Anonymous. We couldn't share anything else, but God, we shared AA together. We got to speak together, speak on podiums. He heard me do my arrogant rant. He'd laugh, you know. He just thought, and he'd pat me on the head and go, you're doing pretty good, kid. Just try not to drink, okay? You know, so. He used to say shit like, the only reason I don't drink now is I'd come back in and Jay would make me finally work the steps, you know. But he was funny and he was cute and he loved Alcoholics Anonymous. He was going to two meetings a week at the end, one of which he took over so it would be run correctly, you know. And we healed. My marriage with my wife at the time when I got sober and the two kids broke up when I was about 8 or 9 years sober. Karen and I met and started seeing each other, and we ultimately got married. My dad was one of the best men at my wedding. And Karen and I started to have an AA house. We both sponsoring people, and we had weird uncles running around the house. And I found my father, and life was heaven. And then I get the call. He's got cancer. He's 85 years old. And he got cancer, and we made the decision together that he wasn't going to do the chemotherapy, that he was just going to go for the ride. And we went for the ride. We brought meetings up to his house, and I sat there with him and held his hand. And my mother and him had been married 62 years. And one day she's sitting on the edge of the bed with him, and she says, Daddy, we had a good marriage, didn't we? He looked right at her and said, without missing a beat, better than I thought it was going to be. He was in the living room of his house. He was in a hospital bed, and the hospice people were there. And my mother and I took care of him, but the hospice people were around, and they sent a minister there to talk to him. And the minister's leaning over the bed, and he goes, Mr. Cleveland, would you mind if I said a prayer over you? And my dad looked at him, and he goes, well, it probably won't do any good, but you need to do it, so what the hell? Only the black humor in Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless the black humor in AA. My mother and I are standing beside the side of the bed, and we needed to clean him up. He had soiled himself. And my mother looked at me and said, "Here we go." And we jumped in there, and I got to see my parents as lovers. That woman had seen his butt many times in her lives, you know. And I got to see her treat him with that loving care, that kindness that is love. Because love is action, isn't it? Isn't that what love is? Isn't that how we love the newcomers? Isn't that how we were loved when we were in AA? People were kind to us. In this whole growing up process, the people I remember that loved me are the ones that patted me on the head and told me, "You're going to be okay, kid. Have a good time." Not the ones that said, "You're going to fall off the pink cloud one of these days," you know. The hell with those people. They don't get it. The people that really love AA love seeing you have a good time. And they give you the space to do what you need to do to grow up just like they did when they were growing up in AA. Because this is where we grow up. And my father loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and we loved each other in AA. And the time came, and he passed away, and we had a wonderful memorial. My mother moved in with me, and then my mother got cancer. And I nursed her in the living room of my house, Karen and I did. And I just stayed home from work. It was our little family business, and I stayed home. I told everybody, "I'm staying home. Call me if you need me." And I nursed her for several months. And the time came when I stood by the side of the bed and it was time to change her diaper. And she was in tears. She thought she had lost her dignity. And I went to start to change the diaper and she stopped me and she cried. And she goes, "You know, I never raised you to do this." And I looked at her and I said, "Oh, yes, you did. I know what you were doing with those people in that home that I was raised in. You were saving their lives. I know now what was going on in that house that I was oblivious to. They got born again, didn't they? Their lives changed. They fell in love with other alcoholics and brought them into their home. They did the best they could to pay back what was so freely given to them." And I looked at her and I said, "You absolutely raised me to do this. You raised me to be, you made me an alcoholic, goddammit." You know? "So shut up and roll over." And I changed your diaper. And we reached a level of intimacy that we didn't know was there. And it isn't a physical level, is it? It's an emotional level. And there was a limitation on the physical. And once we broke that barrier, we entered into a zone that neither one of us knew was there. It's a quiet place, not filled with a lot of words. It's just heart stuff. It's just a feeling. There's something incredibly beautiful about it. And she hadn't lost her dignity, had she? Not at all. The second time was much easier. The third time she goes, "Bill, it's time." And all the Al-Anons showed up at the house and took care of me. One of them took me in the back room, and she looked at me, and she held me. And they're always bringing food, those Al-Anons, you know? You ever notice that? They always got a sack full of something that they're bringing, you know? And this one woman took me in the back of the house, Jean Kissel, and she looked at me, and she said, "Are you okay?" And I go, "Oh, yeah, I'm okay." And she goes, "Are you really?" I went, "No, I'm not okay. I'm a mess, you know?" And she goes, "Good, you know, go clean up the living room now." You know, and they just are there. We're just there for each other, aren't we? We're just there. We're just there. A lot of times there's no words to say. When Al asked me to go into that hospital with him, there weren't any words to say. I was just there. Now let me ask you this question. What would have happened if I'd have said no to that man in my kitchen that day? What if I would have come up with a good, plausible excuse to not have to go into the hospital with him? Would everything turned out the same way it did? I don't have that answer. But I have a suspicion that it would be very different. But I got raised in AA by men who walk into those hospitals, who take care of those people, that answer their phone all the time, that never, ever say no. 80% of the program is working with other people. 80%. It is Alcoholics Anonymous. And if we want our hearts to open up, If I want to be able to love my wife and love my children fearlessly and recklessly without reserve, I will never, ever say no. I will always answer my phone. I'll be there for you as best I can. You can trust me. You can count on me. I won't lie to you. I'll be honest with you. I'll be emotionally honest with you. I will let you into my life the way people let me into theirs. Thank you so much for letting me share this with you today. Thank you.